something for you. He can't be a vagabond. I won't have it.
He is not a vagabond.
How do you know? Do you think he will walk up to you and say, "Hi, I am a vagabond"?
I trust
you are already lost, she said. You tell me you trust him. And I know you are already lost. What's his name?
Henry was the first name I could think of.
Henry what?
I thought hard for a last name for my Henry.
Henry je ne sais quoi. Don't you dare play with me.
I was just joking, I said. I know his last name. It is Henry Napoleon.
Of the Léogane Napoleon?
My mother closed her eyes as though there was a long family registry in her brain. The Léogane Napoleon. Why had I chosen them? There were more illustrious Haitian families. I could see my mother's mind working very quickly. Were they rich, poor, black, mulatto? Were they of peasant stock, literate, professionals?
I want to meet him, she said.
He's not here, I thought quickly. He went back to Haiti after graduation.
Is he coming back?
I don't know.
I want to meet his parents. It's always proper for the parents to talk first. That way, if there's been any indiscretion, we can have a family meeting and arrange things together. It's always good to know the parents.
The parents are in Haiti with him.
Are they ever coming back?
I don't know.
Find out. I want to meet them when they get back.
I leaned over and kissed her cheek to show her that I appreciated her trying to be a good mother. I wanted to tell her that I loved her, but the words would not roll off my tongue. I had to be more careful now that my mother knew I had a love interest. I cooked her favorite meal, rice, beans, and herring sauce, and had it ready for her when she got home. I even used the mortar and pestle to crush onions and spices to add those special flavors she liked. I got A's and B's in chemistry and tried to hide my chagrin whenever Joseph was on a gig in another part of the country. My mother waited very patiently for Henry Napoleon of the Léogane Napoleon to come back from Haiti. Every time she asked about him, she took advantage of the moment to give me some general advice.
It is very hard for the new generation, girls, she began. You will have to choose between the really old-fashioned Haitians and the new generation Haitians. The old-fashioned ones are not exactly prized fruits. They make you cook plantains and rice and beans and never let you feed them lasagna. The problem with the new generation is that a lot of them have lost their sense of obligation to the family's honor. Rather than become doctors and engineers, they want to drive taxicabs to make quick cash.
My mother had somehow learned from someone at work that the Léogane Napoleon were a poor but hard-working clan. She said that in Haiti, if your mother was a coal seller and you became a doctor, people would still look down on you, knowing where you came from. But in America, they like success stories. The worse off you were, the higher your praise. Some real Henry's mother had sold coal in Haiti, but now her son was going to be a doctor. Henry's was a success story. Joseph was away for a month. He sent me postcards and letters from the road. Each day I rushed to the mailbox, making sure I got them before my mother did. I put his jazz legend posters on my walls and stared at them day and night. Whenever my mother was home, I would stay up all night, just waiting for her to have a nightmare. Shortly after she fell asleep, I would hear her screaming for someone to leave her alone. I would run over and shake her, and she thrashed about. Her reaction was always the same. When she saw my face, she looked even more frightened.
Jésus Marie Joseph.
She would cover her eyes with her hands.
Sophie, you've saved my life.
Chapter 11. His first night back home, I went to hear Joseph play. My mother was working, I took a chance. I put on a tight-fitting yellow dress that I had hidden under my mattress. Joseph wore a tuxedo with a tie and cummerbund made of African kente cloth.
"You look like you're all grown up," he said.
"A lot of time has gone by," I said.
"What's time to you and me?"
"Out of sight, out of mind."
"Not your sight, and not my mind."
He always knew all the right things to say. In the car, he told me about how all the towns looked alike after a while when he was traveling, and how he kept thinking about me, and feeling guilty about my mother because he was wanting to steal me away from her. The whole evening was like one daydream. I had never imagined myself in a place like the Note. There was a large dance floor with pink and yellow lights twinkling from the ceiling. That night, Joseph played the tenor saxophone. There was a whimpering sound to it, like a mourning cry. After the show, we drove over the bridge into dawn.
"I have to go away again,"
he said on the steps of my house.
"We have to play in Florida. I think you would love Florida."
He took a small silver ring from his pinky and slipped it onto mine. I felt my eyes close. I let in my first kiss. I did not see him for a while. He was back from Florida but packing to return to Providence. We went for dinner at the Note. This time he wasn't playing. We sat at a table with the other customers. He asked me to marry him. I didn't say no, but I didn't say yes. I wanted time to think. My mother would never allow it. She would go crazy.
"Let's have dreams on it," he said, "and if you never bring it up again, neither will I."
That night, I slept hugging my secret. When my mother came home from work, we went on another ride on the train to watch the lights on the bridge. I wanted to tell her that I loved someone, like maybe she loved Mark, or like she had loved before. "Mama, Henri Napoleon is never coming back," I said.
"It's too bad,"
she said. "I hear from Marie's at work that he's in medical school in Mexico."
"Really? You didn't know?
I thought he was the one sending you those letters from all over the country." She'd made up her part of the story, too. She knew Henri Napoleon did not exist. She was quiet as the train raced over the bridge and back down to the tunnel.
"There are secrets you can't keep," she said. "Not from your mother, anyway."
The next night, after seeing Joseph, I came home to find my mother sitting in the living room. She was sitting there rocking herself, holding a belt in her hand.
"I thought you were dead," she said when I walked in.
I tried to tell her that I had not done anything wrong, but it was 3 in the morning. I wished that I had not asked Joseph to let me go in alone. Perhaps if he had been there. Who knows?
"Where were you?"
She tapped the belt against her palm, her lifelines becoming more and more red. She took my hand with surprised gentleness and led me upstairs to my bedroom. There she made me lie on my bed, and she tested me. I mouthed the words to the Virgin Mother's prayer. "Hail Mary, so full of grace, the Lord is with you. You are blessed among women. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us poor sinners." In my mind, I tried to relive all the pleasant memories I remembered from my life. My special moments with Tante T and with Joseph and even with my mother. As she tested me, to distract me, she told me,
"The Marassas were 2 inseparable lovers. They were the same person, duplicated in 2. They looked the same, talked the same, walked the same. When they laughed, they even laughed the same, and when they cried,
Their tears were identical. When one went to the stream, the other rushed under the water to get a better look. When one looked in the mirror, the other walked behind the glass to mimic her. What vain lovers they were, those Marasa, admiring one another for being so much alike, for being copies. When you love someone, you want him to be closer to you than your Marasa, closer than your shadow. You want him to be your soul. The more you are alike, the easier this becomes. When you look in a stream, if you saw that man's face, wouldn't you think it was a water spirit? Wouldn't you scream? Wouldn't you think he was hiding under a sheet of water, or behind a pane of glass to kill you? The love between a mother and daughter is deeper than the sea. You would leave me for an old man who you didn't know the year before. You and I, we could be like Marasa. You are giving up a lifetime with me. Do you understand? There are secrets you cannot keep, my mother said after the test. I felt like the doll she'd kept all those years in that apartment. A doll which she'd dressed and undressed, and even made a whole room for before I came. I had been jealous of that doll, realizing all the care and attention she had lavished on it. Then one day, both the doll and her trunk full of clothes disappeared. Somehow I knew that she had just gotten up one morning and thrown the doll in the trash, because she no longer had any use for it. She pulled a sheet up over my body and walked out of the room with her face buried in her hands. I closed my legs and tried to see Tontati's face. I could understand why she had screamed while her mother had tested her. There are secrets you cannot keep. Chapter 12. I did not tell Joseph what happened. He left for Providence and stayed away for 5 weeks. My mother still worked night shift. She had no choice. However, she would test me every week to make sure that I was still whole. When Joseph returned, I did my best to avoid him. I was hoping he would go back to Providence and forget that he'd ever met me. He did not give up so easily. One night he banged on the door for 2 hours, and finally I opened it.
"I'm leaving for Providence after next week for good," he said coldly. "I wanted to know if there was anything in this house you wanted."
"I don't want anything," I said, walking away. I twirled the ring around my fingers while listening to the saxophone wailing in the dark. My mother rarely spoke to me since she began the tests. When she went out with Mark, I refused to go, and she showed no desire to take me along. I was feeling alone and lost, like there was no longer any reason for me to live. I went down to the kitchen and searched my mother's cabinet for the mortar and pestle we used to crush spices. I took the pestle to bed with me and held it against my chest. The story goes that there was once a woman who walked around with blood constantly spurting out of her unbroken skin. This went on for 12 long years. The woman went to many doctors and specialists, but no one could heal her. The blood kept gushing and spouting in bubbles out of her unbroken skin, sometimes from her arms, sometimes from her legs, sometimes from her face and chest. It became a common occurrence, soaking her clothes a bright red on very special occasions, weddings and funerals. Finally, the woman got tired and said she was going to see Erzuli to ask her what to do. After her consultation with Erzuli, it became apparent to the bleeding woman what she would have to do. If she wanted to stop bleeding, she would have to give up her right to be a human being. She could choose what to be, a plant or an animal, but she could no longer be a woman. The woman was tired of bleeding. So she went home and divided her goods among her friends and loved ones. Then she went back to Erzuli for her transformation.
What form of life do you want to take? Asked Erzuli. Do you want to be the green lush plant in her garden? Do you want to be a gentle animal in the sea? The ferocious beast of the night?
The woman thought of all the animals that she had seen, the ones that people feared and others that they loved. She thought of the ones that were small, ones that were held captive and ones that were free.
Make me a butterfly, she told Azuli. Make me a butterfly.
A butterfly you shall be, said Azuli.
The woman was transformed and never bled again. My flesh ripped apart as I pressed the pestle into it. I could see the blood slowly dripping onto the bedsheet. I took the pestle and the bloody sheet and stuffed them into a bag. It was gone. The veil that always held my mother's finger back every time she tested me. My body was quivering when my mother walked into my room to test me. My legs were limp when she drew them aside. I ached so hard I could hardly move. Finally, I failed the test. My mother grabbed me by the hand and pulled me off the bed. She was calm now, resigned to her anger.
Go,
she said, with tears running down her face. She seized my books and clothes and threw them at me.
You just go to him and see what he can do for you.
I waited until I heard her moaning in her sleep. I gathered my things and stuffed them into a suitcase. I had to dress quickly. I tiptoed downstairs and opened the front door. I knocked on Joseph's door and waited for him to answer.
Are you in trouble?
He asked. He took me inside and sat me down. I was limping a little. My body ached from the wound the pestle had made. I handed him my suitcase and the pinky ring he had given me. I'm ready for a real ring, I said.
You want to get married?
I nodded. But we have to do it now, I said. Right this very minute.
Without a priest?
I don't care. I was bound to be happy in a place called Providence, a place that destiny was calling me to, fate, a town named after the Creator, the Almighty. Who would not want to live there?
Part 3. Chapter 13.
Great God, Tinguinon, you are beautiful,
the driver said as he stopped under a breadfruit tree in the middle of the sheds, stands, and clusters of women in the open marketplace. I lowered my head and pretended not to hear, but he persisted.
I will crawl inside your dress and live there. I can feed on your beauty like a leech feeds on blood. I would live and die for you, more than the sky loves its stars, more than the night loves its moon, more than the sea loves its mermaids. Strike me, thunder, it's no lie. We do not know one another, I know. Still, I must tell you, you can be the core of my existence, the eye of my we, the first and last letter of my name, which is yours, your humble servant and transporter.
It was a stifling August day. The sun, which was once God to my ancestors, slapped my face as though I had done something wrong. The fragrance of crushed mint leaves and stagnant pea alternated in the breeze. Body-raking compas blared from the car radio as passengers hopped off the colorful van in which I had spent the last 4 hours. The sides of the van were painted in steaming reds, from cherry scarlet to crimson blood. Giraffes and lions were sketched over a terracotta landscape, as though seeking a tint of green. I wouldn't have gotten the coveted seat next to the driver had it not been for what he termed my young charcoal-cloaked beauty. Otherwise, I would have been forced to sit with the market women, their children, livestock, wicker baskets, and the flour sacks that shielded their backs from the sugarcane stalks. Dieu est si bon, proclaimed the letters on the van's front plate. God is good indeed. Otherwise, my daughter Brigitte and I would have never made it this far.
A wonderful trip, pas vrai?
Asked the driver as he unloaded my suitcase. At least we arrived, I said.
It is not my fault, lovely star, if we rocked a little. There are dunes and ridges on the road that I did not put there.
I am not blaming you for those. On the contrary, I'm very grateful we've arrived safely.
All my trips have not been safe. You must be an angel. You bring good blessings. I have been in a ravine or two in the past.
And your passengers?
I would hope they are in heaven.
He peeled a white t-shirt off his chest. Sweat rolled in dancing ripples from his neck to his belly.
You hot too?
He asked. It's dangerous for a woman to undress in public, I said.
Still, I would love to see if you look like a goddess naked. Is there any way you can be persuaded?
I am a married woman.
I see that,
he said, pointing first to my wedding ring and then to my daughter.
She is as perfect as you are, the child.
Ou bien gentil. You are very kind.
I find your Creole flawless,
he said. This is not my first trip to La Nouvelle-Dame-Marie. I was born here.
I still commend you, my dear. People who have been away from Haiti fewer years than you, they return and pretend they speak no Creole.
Perhaps they can't.
Is it so easy to forget?
Some people need to forget.
Obviously, you do not need to forget,
he said. I need to remember. An old hunchbacked lady walked over to pay her fare. He straightened out the dirty gourds and counted them quickly. She walked to the back of the van and pointed out her load of sorghum to a sweaty teenage boy. The boy had a burette, a hand cart made out of two tires and a slab of plywood. He had a group of helpers, younger lads with dust-crusted feet. A young boy followed them with a kite. He ran ahead, tugging the kite string, trying to force it to fly above his head. The old woman nearly tripped over the kite as it crashed to the ground. Brigitte stirred in my arms. She opened her eyes, fluttered her long eyelashes, and then closed them again. A mild breeze rustled the guava trees that now lined the unpaved road. The breeze swept the soil from the hills down to the valley, back to my grandmother's home. Brigitte opened her mouth widely, stretching her lips to their limits as she yawned.
I think Mademoiselle needs to eat again,
the driver said. He was looking across the road at a woman sitting in a stand that was the size of a refrigerator. She was plump and beautiful, with a bright russet complexion. She had a sky-blue scarf wrapped around her head and two looped earrings bouncing off her cheeks. It was Louise, Mangrace's daughter. At the window in front of her was a row of cola bottles.
While you wait for your people, would you like something to drink?
Asked the driver. I could drink an ocean, I said.
If Mademoiselle over there is selling an ocean, I would surely buy it for you.
The female street vendors called to one another as they came down the road. When one merchant dropped her heavy basket, another called out of concern,
Ou libéré?
Are you free from your heavy load? The woman with the load would answer yes if she had unloaded her freight without hurting herself. I sat in the shade of a crimson flamboyant tree at the turn of the forked road. Brigitte quickly tightened her lips around the bottle of milk that I gave her. She sucked the warm liquid as though she hadn't been fed for days. A few Tonton Macoute climbed into the van and settled into the empty seats to eat their lunch. The steaming banana leaves and calabash bowls were in sharp contrast to their denim militia uniforms. They laughed loudly as they threw pieces of grilled meat and small biscuits at each other.
"I have a pig to sell you," whispered a voice behind me.
I was startled. My body plunged forward. I tightened my grip on Brigitte and nearly pushed the bottle down her throat. Brigitte began to cry, spitting the milk out of her mouth.
"Do you have all your senses?" I shouted at the woman.
Her face was hidden behind the flamboyant's drooping branches. I raised Brigitte over my shoulder and tapped her back to burp her.
"Pardon, pardon," Louise said, walking out from behind the tree. "I didn't mean to scare you."
The driver was sitting at the stand in her place, collecting coins and popping the caps off before handing foaming bottles to her customers. I rocked Brigitte until she quieted down.
"I have a pig,"
Louise said, sitting on the rusty grass patch next to me. The tree bark scraped my back as I tried to slide upright.
"Will you look at my pig?"
she insisted.
"I look at you. I see one who loves all God's creatures."
"I have no use for a pig," I said.
"It's a pied, a steel, for 500 gourd.
"I don't need one," I said, shaking my head. "Please, have you seen my tante T?"
"I know you, I do," she said.
"You know Ati too."
"For sure I know Ati. We are like milk and coffee, lips and tongue. We are 2 fingers on the same hand, 2 eyes on the same head."
"Do you know where she is?" "She was supposed to meet me here. I sent her a cassette from America."
"How is dear?"
Her eyes were glowing.
"Is it like they say, large, grand? Are there really pennies on the streets and lots of maid's jobs? Mouen relais, Louise."
"I know who you are."
"My mother was Man Grace."
"I know," I said.
"Gone. My mother is dead now," she said. "She's in Quinon ahead of me. Now I know you too. You are Sophie. Ati can never make herself stop talking about you. I am teaching Ati her letters now, and all she can write in her book is your name."
"I hope she will recognize me when she sees me."
"Folks like Ati know their people the moment they lay eyes on them."
"I've changed a lot since the baby. I bet she's changed too."
"Ati? That old maid change?"
"You are friends, you say?"
"We are both alone in the world since my mother died."
"What could be keeping Tante Ati?" I wondered out loud.
"The wind will bring her soon. It will. Can I ask you a question?"
"What is it?"
"What do you do in America, Sophie? What is your profession?"
"I am dactylo," I said.
"Kisso?"
"A secretary."
"You make money."
"I haven't worked since I had the baby."
"Had enough for this journey, no?"
"I didn't plan on this journey." I laid Brigitte on my lap. Her cheeks swayed back and forth like flesh balloons.
"I want to go to America,"
Louise said.
"I am taking a boat."
"It is very dangerous by boat."
"I have heard everything. It has been a long time since our people walked to Africa, they say. The sea, it has no doors. They say the sharks from here to there, they can eat only Haitian flesh. That is all they know how to eat."
"Why would you want to make the trip if you've heard all that?"
"Spilled water is better than a broken jar. All I need is 500 gourd.
"I know the other side. Thousands of people wash up on the shores. They put it on television, in the newspapers."
"People here too. We pray for them. Stop. Let us stop talking. So sad. It is bad luck in front of a baby.
How old is your baby?
She reached over and tickled Brigitte's forehead. 20 weeks.
De Berting, what did it feel like?
Like passing watermelons.
Woi! She cringed. You look very meg. Bony, not like women here who eat to fill a hole after their babies come out. When you were pregnant, you didn't eat corn so the baby could be yellow?
I never thought of that.
You should have eaten honey so her hair would be soft.
I will remember that.
The next time, maybe.
Maybe.
Your daughter, what is her name?
Brigitte Ife Woods.
Woods? It is not a Haitian name.
No, no. Her father, he is American. She called the boy with the kite over and squeezed a penny between his muddy fingers. With a few whispers in the child's ear, she sent him dashing down the road. She rushed across to her stand and came back with a bottle of papaya cola. My whole body felt cooler as the liquid slipped down my throat.
I know you will pay me later, she said.
Tonta T was standing at the crossroads with a very wide grin on her pudgy face. She had not changed at all. She walked with her hands supporting her back as if it hurt her. A Panama hat tightly covered her head. On her shoulder was a palmetto sewing basket flapping against her wide buttocks.
She must have been on the way, Louise said.
Mean when? I shouted to Tonta T. I'm over here. Tonta T raced towards us. She had to look at me closely to see the girl she had put on the plane. It seemed so very long ago. The years had changed me.
You are already chewing off my niece's ear, she said, tapping Louise's behind. Always trying to give away your soul.
Louise sprang back to her stand.
I would throw myself around you, my aunt said. I would just like a blanket, but I don't want to flatten the baby.
I handed Brigitte to her as I raised myself from the ground.
Who would have imagined it? She said. The precious one has your mama's black face. She looks more like Martine's child than yours.
Chapter 14. Leaves were still piling up on the creeks along the road. A tall girl passed us with a calabash balancing on her head. I carried a small suitcase, mostly filled with Brigitte's things. Brigitte napped as Tonta T carried her in her arms. The women we met on the road called Tonta T Madame, even though she had never married.
I cannot see this child coming out of you, Tonta T said, rocking Brigitte in her arms.
Sometimes I cannot see it myself.
Makes me think back to when you were this small and I had you in my arms. Feels the same too. Like I'm holding something very valuable. Do you sometimes think she's going to break in your hands?
She is a true cuckoo woman. She is very strong. A woman was sitting by the road stringing factory sequins together while her daughter braided her hair. Louise tells me you've learned your letters, I said to Tonta T.
She must think I want that shouted from the hills.
I was very happy to hear it.
I always felt I did, that I knew words in my head. I did not know them on paper. Now, once every so often, I put some nice words down. Louise, she called them poems.
An old lady was trying to kill a rooster in the yard behind her house. The rooster escaped her grasp and ran around headless until it collapsed in the middle of the road. We walked around the bloody trail as the lady picked up the dead animal.
Have you brought your daughter to Martine?
Tonta T asked. She never answers my letters. When I called her, she slammed the phone down on me. She has not seen my daughter. We have not spoken since I left home.
That's very sad for both of you.
very sad, since you and Martine don't have anybody else over there. And Martine's head is not in the best condition.
A man hammered nails into a coffin in front of his roadside hut.
On est, Monsieur Franck?
Tontati called out to the coffin builder.
Respect!
He flashed back a friendly smile.
We have always heard that it is grand there, said Tontati. Is it really as grand as they say, New York?
It's a place where you can lose yourself easily.
Grand or not grand, I am losing myself here too.
We passed Mangray's farm with a bamboo fence around it. The house was worn out and wind-whipped. There were large wooden boards on the windows.
When did Mangrace die? I asked Tontati.
Almost the day I came back to live here, she said.
What was wrong with her?
She went to bed and just stopped breathing. It must have been her time. It was very hard on Louise when her maman died. Louise and Grace, they had slept in the same bed all her life. Louise was in the bed when Grace went to Guinan. To this day, it tears her open to sleep alone.
My grandmother's house still looked the same. I dropped my suitcase on the porch and followed Tontati out to the back. Grandma Ifay was sprinkling water in the dust before doing her sweeping.
Old woman, I brought your children, Tontati said. Age and wedlock tames the beast, said my grandmother. Am I looking at Sophie?
I moved closer, pressing her fingers against my cheeks.
Did you even have breasts the last time I saw you?
Asked my grandmother.
It has not been that long, Tontati said.
My grandmother's eyes were filled with tears. She buried her face in my chest and wrapped her arms around my waist. I called my daughter Brigitte Ifay, I said. The Ifay is after you. She stretched her neck to get a closer look.
Do you see my granddaughter?
She asked, tracing her thumb across Brigitte's chin.
The tree has not split one mite. Isn't it a miracle that we can visit with all our kin simply by looking into this face?
Chapter 15. The lights on a distant hill glowed like a candlelight vigil. We ate supper at the small table on the back porch. A New York skyline was emblazoned in sequins across Tontati's chest. I had hurriedly bought a matching pair of I Love New York sweatshirts for her and my grandmother, forgetting about the lifelong day which kept my grandmother from wearing anything but black to mourn my grandfather. My grandmother chewed endlessly on the same piece of meat as her eyes traveled back and forth between my face and Tontati's chest. I swallowed a mouthful of soursop juice, savoring the heavy screen of brown sugar lingering on my tongue.
Does your mother still cook, Asian?
Asked Tontati with a full mouth. I am not sure, I said. My grandmother lowered her eyelids, sheltered her displeasure, and continued chewing.
And you, can you make some dishes?
Tontati asked. You will have to let me cook a meal, I said. A small draft blew the cooking embers through the yard. My daughter eagerly clawed my neck as I slipped her bottle into her mouth.
Do you go there again tonight?
My grandmother asked Tontati.
The reading, it takes a lot of time, Tontati said. Why do you not go to the reading classes?
You want me to go the whole distance at night?
If you had your lessons elsewhere,
said my grandmother,
they would be during the day. The way you go about free in the night, one would think you are devil.
The night is already in my face, it is. Why should I be afraid of it?
I would like it better, if you were learning elsewhere.
I like where I am.
Can you read only by moonlight?
Knowledge
You do not catch it in the air, old woman.
I have to labor at it. Is that not right, Sophie?
My grandmother did not give me a chance to answer.
You can only labor in the night?
Reading. It is not like the gifts you have. I was not born with it.
Most people are born with what they need,
said my grandmother.
I was born short of my share. You say that to your makers when you see them in Gino.
Do not send me off to my makers, old woman. Besides, my makers should hear me from this place.
My aunt raised her head to the star-filled sky.
Hear me, great gods that made the moon and the stars. You see what you have done to me? You were stingy with the clay when you made this creature.
Blasphemy, spat my grandmother. Why can't the girl come here and teach you your letters?
Tante T got up from the table and walked to the yard. She poured some juice over the cooking ashes as she came back to collect our plates. She took the plates to the yard, scrubbed them with a soap-soaked palm leaf, then laid them out to dry.
Before you go into the night, why don't you read to us from your reading book?
My grandmother shut both her eyes as she twirled a rooster feather in her ear. Tante T walked into the house and came back with a composition notebook wrapped in brown paper. She raised the notebook so it covered her face and slowly began to read. At first she stuttered, but soon her voice took on an even flow. She read the very same words as those I'd written on the card that I'd made for her so long ago on Mother's Day.
My mother is a daffodil, limber and strong as one. My mother is a daffodil, but in the wind, I am strong.
When she was done, she raised her head from behind the pages and snapped the notebook shut.
I have never forgotten those words. I have written them down.
She got up and began walking away.
I am off into the night, she said. The spirits of aloneness, they call to me.
They put me in my mother's room. It had the same four-poster bed and the same mahogany wardrobe with giant hibiscus carved all over it. The mirror on the wardrobe had a wide reflection so that you could see what was happening out on the front and back porches, even as far as the cha-cha tree out towards the road. The mattress sank as I sat on the bed, changing my daughter by the light of a tête gridap, a tin can lamp, named after bald-headed girls. My grandmother was sleeping in the next room. She mumbled in her sleep, like an old warrior in the midst of a battle. My mother used to make the same kinds of sounds.
Lâchez-moi.
Leave me alone. I lay on the mattress with my daughter on my belly. Her breath felt soothing and warm against my bare skin. All we were missing was Joseph. When I was pregnant, Joseph would play his saxophone for us alone in the dark. He would put the horn very close to my stomach and blow in a soft whisper. Brigitte would come alive inside me, tickling like a feather under my skin. Joseph would press his ear against my stomach to hear her every move. He was always afraid that her sudden rotations would hurt me inside. We would both get real quiet to give her a chance to calm down. Sometimes if she had trouble going to sleep, he would stroke my belly and both she and I would doze off immediately. I put on one of Joseph's old shirts to sleep in. Tracing my fingers across my daughter's spine, I asked her questions that she could not possibly answer. Questions that even I didn't know the answers to. Are you going to remember all of this? Will you be mad at Mommy for severing you from your daddy? Are you going to inherit some of Mommy's problems? My daughter was shaking slightly beneath her nightshirt. I felt a sudden urge to tell her a story. When I was a little girl, Tante T had always seen to it that I heard a story, especially when I could not sleep at night.
Creak? Croak!
Honor?
Respect.
There was magic in the images that she had made out of the night. She would rock my body on her lap as she told me of fishermen and mermaids bravely falling in love. The mermaids would leave stars for the fishermen to pick out of the sand. For the most beloved fishermen, the mermaids would leave their combs, which would turn to gold when the fishermen kissed them. Brigitte woke up with a loud wail. She moaned, reaching up to touch my face. I picked up a wet towel and rubbed it over her body. After her feeding, I opened the window a crack. My grandmother would scold me if she knew I was letting the night air into the house. Tontati was standing in the yard, waving to an invisible face. I walked away from the window and lay back down on the bed with my daughter. My grandmother was pacing loudly in the next room as Tontati giggled loudly in the yard. It sounded like she had been drinking. Tontati walked up to the house, her feet pounding the cement.
"Is the lesson over?" asked my grandmother. "Old woman, you will wake up, Sophie," Tontati said. "White hair is a crown of glory," said my grandmother.
"I don't have white hair," said Tontati.
"Only good deeds demand respect. Do you not want Sophie to respect you?"
"Sophie is not a child anymore, old woman. I do not have to be a saint for her."
Chapter 16. I got up to watch the sun rise. I sat on the back steps as clouds of smoke rose from charcoal pits all over the valley. A few small lizards darted through the dew-laden grass, their gizzards bloated like bubble gum. A group of women came trotting along the road, sitting side saddle on overloaded mules. I walked into a small wooden shack, split by a wall of tin into a latrine and a bathing room. In the bathing room was a metal basin filled with leaves and rainwater. Even though so much time had passed since I'd given birth, I still felt extremely fat. I peeled off Joseph's shirt and scrubbed my flesh with the leaves and the water. The stems left tiny marks on my skin, which reminded me of the giant goosebumps my mother's testing used to leave on my flesh. I raised a handful of leaves to my nose. They were a potpourri of flesh healers. Catnip, senna, sarsaparillas, cowosol, the petals of blood-red hibiscus, forget-me-nots, and daffodils. After the bath, I wrapped a towel around me and ran back inside the house. My grandmother was sitting on the edge of her canopy bed. Her mattress had open seams where she stuffed her most precious belongings.
"Sophie, c'est où?"
"It's me," I said, standing in the doorway. Her room was crowded with old baskets, dusty crates, and rusting steel drums. On an old dresser was a statue of Ursule, our goddess of love, who doubled for us as the Virgin Mother. Her face was the color of corn, and wrapped around her long black hair was a tiny blue handkerchief. I went to Tontati's room to get Brigitte. Tontati was bouncing up and down on her four-poster bed with Brigitte between her legs. Her room had no windows. Instead, she had large quilts with bird and fish patterns over the louvers on her wall. I took Brigitte back to my room for a sponge bath. She giggled as I sprinkled scented talc between her legs. Her body was a bit warmer than usual. I looked for the infant thermometer that I'd brought with me. I found it, broken in its case, the mercury scattered in the container. There was a splash in the bathhouse outside the window. My grandmother was naked in the bath shack, with the rickety door wide open. She raised a handful of leaves towards the four corners of the sky, then wrapped the stems under her armpits. She swayed her body several times, shaking the leaves loose from her buttocks. My grandmother had a curved spine and a pineapple-sized hump, which did not show through her clothes. Some years earlier, my mother had grown egg-sized mounds in both her breasts, then had them taken out of her. Chapter 17. We ate cassava sandwiches for breakfast. I dunked mine in a ceramic cup, steaming with dense black coffee. The cassava melted in the coffee, making one thick brew. When I was younger, Tonta T would always pass me more cassava once I'd completely drowned my own. Both Tonta T and my grandmother ate their cassava properly. They chipped off the fragile ends with their teeth and then ventured a sip of the scalding coffee. I kept my daughter on my lap as I dunked a spoon in the cup, trying to rescue the cassava. My grandmother glanced over at Tonta T, then quickly looked away. Tonta T kept her head down as she ate. In the distance, a bell tolled from the cathedral in the town. The bell, that early in the morning, signaled indigents' funerals. I abandoned the cassava and ran a small brush through Brigitte's hair, placing a small white barrette at the tip of a pigtail in the middle of her head. My grandmother threw her head back and swallowed her coffee in one gulp. She reached into her blouse, pulled out a cracked clay pipe, and slipped the mouthpiece between her lips.
"I'm going to do the mashi," announced my grandmother.
She unhooked her satchel from the back of her chair as she got up from the table. One of her legs dragged slightly behind the other. The inside of her lagging foot was so calloused that it had the same texture as the red dust in the yard. "Can I come too?" I asked my grandmother.
"Surely," she said. "You just follow my shadow."
Brigitte let out a loud cry as I handed her to Tonta T. "Mommy will bring you a nice treat from the market," I said, hearing Tonta T's voice echo from my childhood. Brigitte shrieked loudly, her face tied up in tear-soaked knots.
"Hurry, go,"
urged Tonta T. I rushed down the road to catch up with my grandmother. In the cane fields, the men were singing songs once bellowed at the old combites.
"Bonjour, comment il fait," they chanted.
"Bonjour, good men," replied my grandmother.
"This here is my granddaughter, Uncle Basie,"
my grandmother said to an old man sitting on the side of the road. He was slashing a machete across a thin piece of sugar cane. He took off his hat and bowed in my direction.
"Where about she from?"
asked the old man.
"Here,"
answered my grandmother.
"She's from right here."
My grandmother shopped like an army general on rounds.
"Man, les gros, time is God's to waste, not ours. I want a few cinnamon barks, some ginger roots, and sweet potatoes to boil in my milk. Make the potatoes sweet enough so I won't need to put sugar in the milk."
"Only the grandmaster, he can do that,"
answered Man Le Gros, as she tugged at an old apron around her waist.
"I want me a mammit of red beans, too," said my grandmother. "The beans don't need sweetness."
She watched closely as Man Le Gros dug a tin cup into a hill of beans spread out on a piece of cardboard on the ground.
"Give those beans some time to settle in the cup," said my grandmother. "Let them rest in the cup. Between you, between me, we know half of them is pebbles."
"No pebbles here," said Man Le Gros.
She had a blackened silver tooth on either side of her mouth. My grandmother reached inside her blouse and pulled out a small bundle. She unwrapped a cord around the little pouch, fished out a handful of crumpled gourds, and paid Man Le Gros. Louise was sitting at her stand, selling colas to a few makout dressed in bright denim uniforms and dark sunglasses. They were the same ones who had gotten in the van yesterday. Louise was chatting and laughing along with them, as though they were all old friends. One of them was staring at me. He was younger than the others, maybe even a teenager. He stood on the tip of his boots and shoved an old man aside to get a better look. I walked faster. He grabbed his crotch with one hand, blew me a kiss, then turned back to the others. The kite boy was tugging at the young Makut's starched denim pants, begging for a penny. The Makut reached inside his pocket and handed the child a coin. The boy dashed across the road to buy a piece of sugarcane and mint candy. My grandmother grabbed my hand and pulled me away. We walked up to a line of cloth and hat vendors with samples draped across their chests and hats piled on their heads.
"I have this at home,"
said my grandmother, rubbing the edge of a white fabric against her face.
"It would be for my burial."
"Have you come to buy my pig?" Louise asked.
She followed us as we toured the fruit stands. My grandmother refused the mango chunks that the vendors handed to her, preferring instead to squeeze and pump the custard apples she wanted to buy.
"You well, grand-mère?"
Louise asked, jumping in front of my grandmother.
"Oui, I got up this morning. I am well."
"And you, Sophie, you well?"
"Very well," I answered. "Thank you."
"Will you buy the pig?"
"Don't you have things to look after?"
snapped my grandmother. The boy with the kite was sitting in Louise's stand for her. Louise kept following us, ignoring my grandmother's coldness.
"My foot, you see. You stepped on it."
The baby-faced Makut was shouting at a coal vendor. He rammed the back of his machine gun into the coal vendor's ribs.
"I already know the end,"
said my grandmother. She grabbed my hand and pulled me away. She wobbled quickly, her sandals hissing as the lazy foot swept across the ground. Louise rushed back to her stand. My grandmother and I hurried to the Flamboyant and started on the road home. I turned back for one last look. The coal vendor was curled in a fetal position on the ground. He was spitting blood. The other Makut joined in, pounding their boots on the coal seller's head. Everyone watched in shocked silence, but no one said anything. My grandmother came back for me. She grabbed my hand so hard my fingers hurt.
"You want to leave your nightmares too?"
she hollered. We walked in silence until we could hear the combit song from the cane fields. The men were singing about a platonade, a loose woman who made love to the men she met by a stream and then drowned them in the water. My grandmother spat in the dirt as we walked by Louise's shack.
"Are you mad at Louise?" I asked.
"People have died for saying the wrong things," answered my grandmother.
"You don't like Louise?"
"I don't like the way your tante Tia has been since she came back from Croix de Rosée. Ever since she has come back, she and I, we are like milk and lemon, oil and water. She grieves. She drinks tafia. I would not be surprised if she started wearing black for her father again."
"Maybe she misses Croix de Rosée."
"Better she go back then. You bring a mule to water, but you cannot force it to drink the water. Why did she come back? If she had married there, would she not have stayed?"
"If she had married there, then you would be living with her and her husband."
"Those are the old ways," she said. "These days, they go so far, the children. People like me, we look after ourselves."
"Tanta T wants to look after you."
"I looked after myself all these years she was in Croix de Rosée. I look after myself now. Next, when we hear from your mother, I will ask her to send for Ati, so Ati can go and see New York. See the grandness, like you have."
"Don't you want to go?"
"I have one foot in this world, and one foot in the grave. No, I do not want to go. But Ati, she should go. She cannot stay out of duty. The thing she does, one should do out of love."
"Do you tell her that you do not want her to stay?"
"I would tell her if she ever engaged me in talk. Your tante T, she has changed a lot since she was with you. The reading, it is only one thing."
"I think it is very good that she has learned to read," I said. It is her own freedom.
There is a story that is told all the time in the valley. An old woman has three children. One dies in her body when she's pregnant. One goes to a faraway land to make a fortune, and never does that one get to come back alive. The last one, she stays in the village and looks after her mother.
Tonta T was the last. Chapter 18. Tonta T was stretched out in an old rocker. Brigitte lay on her lap. My grandmother took her beans to the yard to pick out the pebbles. She fanned a small fire with her hat, washed the beans, then put them to boil in a pot. Brigitte yawned in her sleep as I picked her up. Tonta T got up, grabbed her notebook from the floor, and peered at the pages. She held the notebook so close to her face, I thought there was a mirror inside. "I didn't realize you would remember the words of my card this long," I said. "When you have something precious, you do not forget it." She pressed her notebook against her chest as she started for the road.
"Are you going to the marché?"
my grandmother called out.
"You need something?"
asked Tonta T.
"The Makut were doing damage," my grandmother said. "Fighting.